Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Every episode, I sit down with different guests who have bootstrapped companies, masterminded investment models, or built a business empire. They're leaders in their field, and they're here to give you top insights and actionable advice so that you can apply their ideas to your own career or business venture.
What does it take to leave a successful finance career and build a company in a market that doesn't yet exist? Today on All About Business, I'm joined by Timo Bolt, founder and CEO of Gusto, the recipe box company he launched in 2012 at the very beginning of the meal kit category in the UK. We'll explore how Gusto helped pioneer a new way of buying and cooking food, how technology and AI underpin its highly personalized model, and why Timo believes food companies will become preventative health businesses in the future. Well, today on All About Business, I'm really delighted to welcome Timo Bolt, who is the founder and CEO of a wonderful business called Gusto. Thank you for coming in to talk to me today, Timo. I congratulate you on creating a business that's not only grown, but is giving people good, healthy options to eat food in new and different ways at a time when so much food, particularly in Britain, is processed. So I'd like to start our conversation really by giving you an opportunity to describe what Gusto does and why you started this wonderful business.
Thanks for having me. It's a privilege to be here. Gusto, I founded Gusto 14 years ago, and the premise was 30-40% of food is wasted in this country. So it's a massive CO2 problem. And then 60% of diet here in the UK is ultra-processed food. And so what you put into your body, now science is telling us, has profound impact on your longevity, health span, how your organs function. Yet we're putting 60% of calories into our bodies from UPF. And so that was kind of the initial idea, to give people across the UK a healthier way to eat dinner. And the way it works is you choose from 200 recipes on your app, and you get all the ingredients delivered, and you still have to cook, but we make it a bit easier, healthier, and more fun.
So there's a lot here. UPF, ultra processed food. That's sort of what we want to replace in a
yes, and we're the world leaders only with the US.
So we eat in Britain more processed food than anybody else, yeah, apart from people in the US, yeah, which has led to widespread, you're saying, health and other issues.
And huge cost too. Yeah. 136 billion on cost into the NHS because of poor diet.
Right. So poor diet is a big issue, and you're looking to address that, or give people the opportunity to address that in their lifestyle choices. And to do so, you need to get an app, you said. What is the app called? How do you find it? That's the first question.
Gusto on the App Store, or the Android app. Very easy. And then a couple of clicks and you get, you know, all your meals delivered. You just click on whatever you like to eat, really. Healthy meals, quick meals, family meals, Asian meals, pizza, whatever you like. And then we deliver everything to you.
And everything's delivered. So it arrives in a Gusto box, mm-hmm, with directions on how to cook, mm-hmm, it.
You've got a little recipe card, and then you follow 8 basic steps. And after 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you're done. And hopefully you have a delicious meal.
Well, it only takes that long to cook.
A lot of the meals, not all of them. If you want to have the 60-minute extravaganza on Saturday night, you know, be my guest. We've got that.
Is it called that?
No, it should.
Yeah, that sounds good. But so you can choose how long it takes to cook.
Yes, yeah.
And who are your customers? You know, who were the first people to sort of start thinking, I want to embrace this, I want to try this?
So I would say 35 to 55, female, living outside of London. It's quite competitive from a pricing perspective. We're trying to cater for the masses, not the classes. And so meals start at £3.20. And we deliver to all of the UK, Highlands, Islands, wherever you live.
£3.20 a head, is that?
Yes, yeah, per person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Fresh food from the farm, you know, X of your 5 a day. Good from a protein perspective, fiber perspective. And so we're not saying food is medicine. we're saying this is a more convenient and healthy and tasty way to eat. But we are, over time, I think, becoming a preventative healthcare company, which is not obvious today.
No, I can see how that might happen. So you started off female customers 35 to 55. Would they be typically cooking several meals? I mean, would they be ordering for four or six people? I mean,
the core customer is buying for four or five people.
So it's like a family unit.
Family unit. And they normally buy four recipes. Most customers get it delivered on, which is a logistical nightmare because the concentration is so vast. But most people want to have it delivered on a Sunday or Monday to cook during the week. Everyone is competitively busy running after toddlers and having chores. And so they just want to have a little bit of a simpler life. And Gusto is providing convenience, but without the compromise. So you're not compromising on price, health, CO2 emissions, these things.
I like that expression, convenience without the compromise. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to have all the toxins that come with
processed. Because you can get a pizza delivered faster than us. That's more convenient than Gusto, but you're compromising on a couple of levels there.
Yeah, I can see that. So what gave you the idea to start this? I mean, you were working in banking, weren't you? Investment banking?
I was an investment banker. I stumbled into banking in 2008. I studied finance and my professor said, look, you like numbers. Have you heard of M&A and banking? I didn't. I had no clue.
Your professor, where was this? Was it?
I studied in the US and Germany.
Right. You're from Berlin originally.
I am from Berlin, yes. Yeah. The German accent has never gone away. I've lived here for 18 years.
Yeah.
Speak English to my kids, surprisingly. But and so my professor really pushed me and he said, look, Goldman Sachs is recruiting. You should go. I had no idea what M&A is. I mean, a completely embarrassing experience. Didn't get
so
an
internship.
So you
worked in Goldman Sachs?
No, I didn't. So I didn't even get an internship.
You didn't get an internship.
I didn't know what the guys were talking about, like WEC and, you know, all these
lots of acronyms.
Weird. Yeah. And then I did look into it more and then I studied up on it and I got a job offered at Rothschild. I was briefly in New York and Frankfurt.
Rothschild's is pretty high ranked, I would have said.
Yeah, it was good. Somebody said, look, would you like a job in London? And I had never been to London.
Right.
The day after my final exam, I was on a plane to London and it took me some time to culturally get used to the language. My first, just one quick memory, but the first offside, the Rothschild kind of introduction offside, it said casual.
Right.
And so, you picture 30 people from Oxbridge wearing cufflinks and a jacket and me in a t-shirt because I didn't understand what casual means.
I think you did and they didn't, but
I gained an analytical toolbox and I really enjoyed kind of meeting smart people, but then I left after 2.5 years to join a hedge fund. And again, I thought, banking is not for me. I want to be more entrepreneurial. I want to be on the buy side. And again, to be honest, it took me a long time to learn, but it just wasn't for me. I didn't enjoy finance and I wanted to.
But that's a journey that many people go on early in their career, is trying things and then finding something that is for them.
And you need serendipity. And
So you came here from, as a new arrival to London. You said, the language, the culture. What about the food? I mean, is that part of what motivated you to do this? Or am I being unfair?
Not initially, if I'm being brutally blunt. No, but I mean, in fairness, London has such amazing variety.
It does.
Wow. And, the types of restaurants, the quality, the standards, even the produce you can get. And so over time, I fell in love with London and the food scene and the restaurants and the choice and the wider UK. But it wasn't an initial love affair.
Yeah. So what? How did this idea sort of develop in your mind from working in a hedge fund?
So I before I started working, I did my senior high school in the US, and my godparents are hardcore entrepreneurs who have built dozens of companies, small companies, ice cream places, a restaurant, an organic supermarket, a vineyard, these types of
businesses. These are people you were living with.
So they found a host family for me.
Oh, I see.
This was post 9/11 in 2001. Right. host families didn't want to take German students in.
Right.
And my godmother hustled, and she convinced her neighbors to take in this German kid who couldn't speak English.
Right.
And I got to play American football, and I firsthand saw my godparents kind of have this amazing lifestyle. Yeah. And have all these businesses. And I kind of felt like, you know, at age 16, I want to do what they are doing.
Yes.
Versus my dad, who was kind of slaving away and working really long hours.
Well, he but worked for a corporation in Germany.
He did, yeah.
So you sort of thought, oh, this entrepreneurial thing looks quite good.
I should get into this. Yeah.
You thought, yeah. They were sort of multiple entrepreneurs.
I mean, they had endless businesses. They had a pain practice. He was a doctor. She was a dentist. So they had a dentist practice. And then these kind of businesses created enough income to start a lot of other businesses on top. And, you know, most of them failed. They've never raised money. They don't have boards.
The fact that they never raised money suggests that overall they've been very successful.
Overall, they have been very successful, yeah.
Did you know that there are nearly 1 million 18 to 24-year-olds who are currently not in education, employment, or training in the UK? This is simply not good enough, and I want to do something about it. That's why Reed is launching a new initiative, giving £20,000 to young entrepreneurs to help them grow their small business. Visit reed.com/entrepreneurs to find out more. We want to support and encourage the next generation of entrepreneurs. So that was a sort of early eye-opener for you.
Yeah, and it pushed me, you know, provenance, food, purpose. Is this good for the planet? Let's walk the vineyard. This is how we do kind of the farming. And it just really kind of impressed me. And so I always dreamed about having a business myself one day in the food space. And then I joined finance and they kept on pushing, Timo, why are you in finance?
Oh, so your
quit your job.
Your friends in California were saying, hang on a minute, what's going on, Timo?
You can always get a job again. So if you quit your job, no kids, no mortgage, there's no risk. And if you fail, well, you learned how to cook. So just get on with it.
What you just said really resonated with me. You can always get a job again. And it's so true.
Yeah.
I mean, people think, oh, you know, this is a huge risk. But is it really? It's just having a go at something else.
Yeah.
So you've sort of reflected. So you were sitting in an office working for a hedge fund, thinking about food and
working 100 hours,
being an entrepreneur,
dreaming about food and being an entrepreneur.
And one day, what happened? You decided to take the plunge.
I decided to take the plunge. I worked 100 hours. I couldn't even write a business plan, but I had the strong calling to do something that's more purposeful and that is related to food. And so I started dreaming about how can you make diet better across the UK? How can you give customers better, more fun kind of ways to cook dinner? And the most important, the high stakes kind of meal of the day, how can you make that better? And this then morphed into the Gusto idea over time. But I just, at some point, I just knew I need to quit my job to pursue this fully.
And you did this on your own, the Gusto idea?
I had a co-founder for 3 years.
Okay.
So for the last 11 years, I've been by myself. And then initially, I had a co-founder.
So when you started, could you describe the scene? I mean, where were you? What were you doing? How did it work?
So I moved back into student accommodation. My girlfriend back then did her PhD in Oxford University. And so we moved into the tiniest place in Oxford. I took the 7 a.m. train to get to London. And we rented this tiny space, which served as a test kitchen / office / everything.
Where was that?
I was near Shepherd's Bush, but not where you have a tube station, a train station, or even a bus. So you had to walk quite long to an industrial complex. You had a Shell gas station and a Tesco, a tiny Tesco convenience store. So it was fairly basic. And downstairs, my co-founder or I would cook, and upstairs, one of us would work. And you know, the fumes and smell.
So you were cooking the meals or preparing the food.
I developed
boxing it up and delivering it.
I developed the first kind of 40, 50 Gusto recipes.
Did you?
They're all blacklisted now, I think.
Right.
I tell the team for supply chain reasons, but I mean, in fairness, the chefs are much better today.
So that's the reason. Oh, that's a shame. You should have one signature recipe, shouldn't you?
I think I deserve one.
I think so. I think you should go back there and get one back in. So you started doing this. So how did you get your first order? How did you tell people this was a possibility?
I mean, purely hustling. You know, we went to the train station, handed out flyers, begged people to try. And every weekend I would go to food festivals with a pestle and mortar, making kind of samples of how amazing pesto would taste.
Right.
And you know, doing this for 10 hours and trying to chat up people and say, would you like to try this? Here's a flyer. This is amazing.
Sort of Olympia
we change your life. But I mean, you know, we had initially we might have had 2 customers, 5 customers, 7 customers.
And you would take the boxes.
And then I would hand deliver to these customers in Oxford and London. So I would take these boxes on the train to Oxford back home and then hand deliver in Oxford.
The economics of that don't sound great.
No, and I couldn't afford a car. So, I mean, it was completely unscalable.
Okay, so how did you solve that conundrum? How did you scale up from that to what is obvious? Just describe how big it is now. How many people work for this company now?
Today, we've got 1,600, 700 people.
1,700 people delivering. How many meals would you deliver a day or a week?
We did 80 million meals in 2025.
80 million meals.
80 million meals.
So that's a long way from you on your own in Shepherd's Bush with your partner.
I feel very privileged today, yeah.
So, I mean, that's a brilliant achievement, but how did you do it? I mean, what's the story here?
I mean, we really, really wanted to succeed. And I think we had this boundless curiosity and we just thought naively, we will make this work no matter what. But we weren't fixated on this price point or these types of recipes. We changed everything based on the conversations we had. So we went to the tube station, talked to people, took into account their feedback, changed the website overnight, tweaked everything.
So you were learning all the time.
All the time, yeah.
And it's interesting to me, you were talking to customers all the time because you were delivering the food or at the tube station.
I gave them my phone number and they would literally call until 1 a.m.
Not after 1 a.m. How nice of them. Yeah. So you were very much in touch with your market.
Yeah.
Are you still able to do that?
I'm now running a much bigger extent, company. I still try to. I still talk to customers all the time. I gave some of these early customers, I gave one symbolic share in Gusto and I framed it nicely.
Right.
And I went to their house and I said, thank you. You believed in us. You know, we now raised some money and the company is kind of going somewhere. And please be a shareholder and I want to say thank you. And so I stayed in touch with these early customers and some are still buying today and we're on year 14 now.
Right.
And so I tried to connect with customers as much as I can.
So you said then subsequently you raised some money.
We did manage to raise.
What did you do? What was the...
Family and friends initially.
Right.
I was naive. I didn't know what a VC fund is or what angel investors are. I didn't know rich people. And so we hustled kind of in the network of the few people we knew.
Yeah.
And then I kind of over time started to get to know angel investors and I learned what a VC fund is. I went onto Dragon's Den. That was fantastic from
a PR perspective. Did they invest in you?
They didn't invest. They made 2 offers on the show.
Spot their mistake, eh?
Yes.
They didn't. They made 2 offers on the show.
They didn't miss out. But it was amazing.
You're quite glad on that.
Yeah,
kept the shares, I guess. Yeah.
And so we tried everything. We just sent random people. If I had known you back then, I would have sent you 5 postcards.
I'm very sad you didn't. So you went out to your network. But this is good advice for people who does know VCs and angel investors, actually? I mean, you're not alone, are you? So if you want to grow a business,
and I
your advice
myself.
Is very helpful. What you did is what worked for you anyway.
Yeah, and I challenged myself. You know, I the most influential person I knew from Rothschild, for example, was the managing director who was kind of near me and I worked for him. But then I thought, why not message the chair of Rothschild?
Yeah.
Well, what
aim
could
high.
Go wrong?
Yeah.
And so I sent these 100 Christmas cards to 100 people totally out of my reach. And I would say 5 responded. And so the chair of Rothschild, for example, did respond and said, yeah, sure, I mentor you and I'll buy you a coffee. And you know. And he then invested later and we're still in
contact. So was that what your request was? Would you mentor me on a Christmas card?
Yeah.
What could go wrong is what you just said. I mean, basically nothing. I mean, the answer's just no or yes.
Yeah, you know, it costs you £100 and 95 people have not responded. So Tony Blair, if you're listening,
Tony,
you
missed a trick here. But it's not too late. I'm sure he's a regular listener of our podcast. But that's very interesting. But So you had five respond. I think sending people things in the post sounds outdated to a lot of young people, but it actually works because you don't get that. I mean, I've just been away for a week, came back, and there were five envelopes on my desk. I opened and looked at every one of them. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked at my email yet.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's very powerful.
So that worked for you. So looking at the scene now, you've expressed concern that the sort of food system in Britain is, I think you've used the word broken.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think needs to happen? Because there are a lot of concerns around people eating too much processed food and not being able to cook healthy food. You're obviously presenting an option, but what else needs to happen?
I mean, since 1990, we've seen a fourfold increase in obesity levels across the world and even more in the UK. And then we talked about ultra-processed food, how the UK is leading in bad nutrition pretty much, next to the US. And you've got $135 billion on costs for the NHS due to bad nutrition. And now science is clearly showing the evidence between what you put into your body and your longevity. And you can literally take 10 years of your life expectancy off if you kind of continuously eat bad food.
You've talked about the bliss point. Mm-hmm. I read this, which is a combination of salt, sugar, and fat, which is, yeah, the sort of tempting stuff that... This is the hook they get us on, is it?
This is the hook. People manufacture the bliss point to get you addicted and to massively overeat beyond the point where you should stop. And in addition, the food we eat is full of additives. Like if you go to the local supermarket and you look at stuff, oh my God, like it's full of stuff that it shouldn't have in there.
Yes.
And it's fundamentally bad for you.
And but the additives are put there for what reason?
To extend shelf life. To make it tastier artificially, you know, to be able to claim no sugar. Right. But then, of course, lots of additives and stuff.
Yeah.
And ultimately, these things are really cheap. Salt is cheap, sugar is cheap, additives, chemicals are cheap. And so if you want to have a juicy margin as a food manufacturer,
right.
You put more of this addictive stuff in.
Yeah.
And if you don't have to pay for the consequence then is the NHS is on its knees.
Yeah,
but your profits are going up, and so you have this moral dilemma, and no business in the world will ever then decide, okay, we walk away from this. This is bad for humans. People get addicted to the profits, and so I'm not huge on regulation, but here you really clearly have to regulate.
Well, people get addicted to the product and the profits,
yeah.
And I mean, I'm thinking about tobacco when you were describing, which is clearly a poisonous product that has been very highly taxed and its marketing very much curtailed in my lifetime. You know, it was very glamorous when the Marlboro Cowboy and stuff when I was young. And now you look at a packet of cigarettes, if you're able to see one, and it's grotesque.
Yep.
This level of attention has not been applied to the type of poisoning you're describing in the food category. And it seems that when people do say, oh, we're going to put a tax on salt, you know, there's this huge outcry from the press, you know, nanny state and...
Mm.
But if the state has to pick up the costs in terms of keeping people alive in the NHS or looking after their health, that can't be a reasonable state of affairs, can it? I mean,
no, and we need to move away from the notion that you just need a better mindset and better habits, because ultimately these additives, you know, are really strong and they make you addicted, and so. Yeah, I mean, I see the nanny state argument everywhere, but ultimately it's just a grossly unfair system, and to make it more fair and to protect the vulnerable. If you are in the top, in the bottom 20% of income, 80% of your calories are ultra-processed food.
Because it's the cheapest food.
And for kids, it's 90% of calories are ultra-processed food in these poor demographics because it's the cheapest food. And so you have to just change that.
I mean, that is terrible. And you're saying this takes 10 years off your life expectancy from recent scientific research.
Yeah.
So we're feeding the most vulnerable, the worst food.
Yeah.
And
willingly and knowingly.
Doing that.
And we have so much scientific evidence now that's kind of showing the link between bad nutrition and health outcomes that now really is the time to kind of do something and intervene.
But what I've also observed is a lot of these processed foods, you don't have to cook even.
Yeah.
You know, you just get them, eat them straight away or warm them up or put them in a microwave. So they've made everything very easy
and
cheap.
And especially in the UK, we're made to believe that convenience comes with a compromise. And what we're trying to say is, no, 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 you can have it all. You don't have to compromise. But somehow we've been conditioned to believe that we're all competitively busy and we have to sacrifice quality in order for us to gain some time.
Right.
But that's not the case.
That's absolutely not the case.
You can have it all.
You can have it all. Well, why not? But I am sort of interested in how to address that. The less well-off demographic where children are eating that percentage of processed food. How could society help that group of people better? Because, I mean, your price point is not high, but some people in that category might struggle to pay for your meals on a regular basis, clearly.
Mm.
How can you make good food more affordable and more attractive to
you probably
the poorest
have to
people
start.
In the community?
With school meals, university meals, NHS meals, can you start by making these healthy as a starting point?
Right.
And then how do you tax UPF companies and products so that you can subsidize kind of the better stuff?
Yeah. So there's huge taxes placed on sort of energy companies. Mm. Maybe there should be huge taxes on some of these other companies, is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
and then the money's recycled to make other food more affordable.
Absolutely. And you gotta hold these supermarkets and manufacturers to account. Reporting has to be more transparent, labeling has to be more transparent. So do we really understand what companies are doing?
Timo, you've described the business and the service and the products you offer. I mean, it's quite complex, it seems. What are your key challenges? What are the challenges you face at Gusto today?
I mean, we have huge opportunities, but from a challenges perspective, look, cost of living crisis, UK economy is not fantastic, mortgage rates are not going down, they're actually going up at the moment, the Iran war is causing energy spikes, and so we really care about how our customers are feeling and how they're doing, and consumer confidence is fairly grim at the moment. And so since the beginning of the cost of living crisis, we've kept inflation to 60% of what supermarkets pushed into customers. And so in relative terms, Gusto has become more attractive to customers, but it is our job and obligation to protect these families from price rises. And so cost and price is really, really important to us.
And I know you like to source sort of locally produced food. I mean, what's the situation in farming? I mean, we hear that that's quite challenged too. What's the situation that you're experiencing?
Yeah, I mean, farming is challenged. Ultimately, people are addicted to these chemicals and they eat ultra-processed food and not the food from the farm they should be eating. And so as a country, we got to tax on this side and we got to subsidize on this side and we got to support farmers more.
So who's being subsidized? The processed food?
Mm-hmm.
Really? And the farmers are being taxed?
I mean, both are taxed. But you have to feel the balance isn't right. The balance is wrong.
Right.
If you want to eat more healthily in the UK, you have to help these farmers. We have amazing farms in the UK.
We do. And amazing farmers.
Yeah.
So we should certainly, I certainly support what you just said. There's an app I was told about that you pointed at the barcodes on things and it'll tell you whether it's healthy or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite surprising what comes up. Mm-hmm. I mean, some things that look quite healthy, you know, get a big red circle, and things that maybe don't are okay.
Yeah.
So that level of information is not widely available either, is it?
No. And often, you buy, I don't know, a garlic salt. And then suddenly you look at it and there's sugar added in it. Why do you need sugar and garlic salt?
Yeah.
And so it's quite surprising once you start studying these labels.
Yeah, years and years ago, my French friend was complaining about British mayonnaise having sugar in it. But I think he was onto something.
Yeah.
He was horrified. So,
but I promise you, they did the study in their lab and they realized the retention and frequency, shopping frequency is better if they secretly add sugar. And then they kept on raising it because sugar is so cheap. But people got more addicted
and
to
more
the taste.
Addictive than cocaine, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why they do that.
Yeah.
I mean, this doesn't reflect well on business. I mean, I'm an advocate for business. I'd like to think, a champion of entrepreneurs, but business isn't behaving well here, is it?
No, and look, I get it. The short-term pressure and profit margins, and ultimately that's become the god to pray to. But here it has a really, really, really nasty negative consequence.
So, I mean, it's not as bad as the opioid scandal in America, but there's an aspect of that in this, you know, putting things in products that hook people and keep them coming back for more that isn't good for them. That it might shock many people, I think. But
yeah,
you were obviously onto that a long time ago. I mean, you said that it was since 1990 obesity's quadrupled. So this was obviously something you were aware of a long time ago.
And crisp
and you started trying to create an answer.
Yeah.
Crisp packages
have become bigger and bigger and bigger. And we're just addicted to these foods.
So yeah, I was thinking of crisps when I was thinking of the bliss point.
Oh, so good.
Oh, no, I'm on a motorway and I think I might stop and get some salt and vinegar. I mean, yeah, that's the trouble though. It's got all those ingredients in, isn't it?
For me, it's binary, right? Once I stop that crisp back, I'll eat it all and then I want another one.
Yeah.
And so it's easier in the first place to not start because I can't control it.
No, nor can I. So that's good advice. So you've started this business with this objective, but you've said you're moving it, or there's a sense that you might be moving into preventative health. I mean, is that a strategy or is that an observation, or how do you see that shaping up going forwards?
So it is part of the strategy, but you got to be really careful. If you just tell people this is super healthy food, you lose your mainstream appeal. People still want to have a burger and they still want to have sausages and they still want to indulge. And so we're not here to take away all the fun.
No.
We still want to make the meals as tasty as possible, but we want to do it in a way that's good for you. And so over time, we're leveraging the personalization ability to make the meals better and better and better. And so, for example, we just have taken, you know, X% of salt out of the menu, but we've done it in a way that kind of retention didn't go down, frequency didn't go down. And so you as a customer don't even know, but we're making the menu better and better and better.
Right. And I understand you're using AI to help customize menus and that every menu is potentially different. How are you doing that?
Yeah, so you and I should never see the same menu. We should see very personalized and customizable menus. And so for the last 10 plus years, we've built 17 AI products that power the factories, that decide what you and I should see based on what we've ordered the last couple of weeks.
You've been doing that for 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, employee number 8 was a PhD in machine learning.
Right, so you're well ahead of the curve. Obviously.
And he was amazing. He cut forecasting waste and saved us lots of money. And so we got addicted to data science early on, luckily.
Right.
And so we asked him, what else can you do? And so he moved from forecasting to order routing optimization, where how does the order travel through the factory, and how do we put tomatoes on the first station in the factory, the last one, all 150 stations? I mean, no human can ever kind of calculate these things.
No.
And every time he updated the algorithm, magically our labor costs went down.
Right.
And you still need people who have 50 years of factory experience.
Yeah.
But then you also need these 20-year-old kids with PhDs in machine learning. And together they did magical stuff. And so we got quite addicted to the power of data science early on.
Well, it reassures me you still employ 1,700 people in this environment, because that's what success can bring. But you got addicted to data science. So how does it work now? Why would my menu be different to yours? Because of what I've eaten in the past, or what I look at, or how does it work?
Exactly. It takes into account what you've chosen in the last couple of weeks. It looks at customers that have chosen similar recipes to you, but have then ordered XYZ, and so it starts to recommend the same. It looks at the stuff you browse, how much time are you spending on these. So it takes all these cues into account and then kind of creates a personalized menu, and 80% of chosen recipes are now from that AI-driven menu.
80%. So you mentioned you had a factory, and a few moments ago you were talking about this little workshop in Shepherd's Bush. Where's your factory now, and how does it work?
We've got a massive factory in Warrington, and then we've got one in Lincolnshire. So right. The breadbasket of the UK, flat land, potatoes everywhere.
Great. Why did sausages. You choose those locations?
They already have a lot of manufacturing capabilities, factories, a lot of people who want to work in food manufacturing.
In Warrington and Lincolnshire. Mm. Lincolnshire, yeah. So is that where all the meals are assembled? Which do they perform different functions, those factories, Lincolnshire and Warrington?
Slightly different degree of automation and data science, but I mean, broadly the same.
And then you must have a huge logistics, or do you...
piggyback on the existing couriers, so Yodel, DPD,
right.
Royal Mail, they deliver for us, and the box is compartmentalized, and there's a cool box, a chilled kind of compartment in there, so the food stays fresh for 36 hours. You can just leave it out the door. We obviously temperature probe, test all the time.
So those companies are pitching for your business, basically. Yep. Mm-hmm. So Royal Mail, DPD.
And the main reason is we initially tried to, I mean, hand deliver myself, but you put so many more CO2 emissions on the street. Whereas if you can piggyback on the existing supply chain and they send an Amazon delivery to the Highlands, why not take the Gusto box in the same van?
Yeah.
So it was a lot more economic and a lot better for the environment.
And does your data analyst look at all those options as well?
Yeah.
So that, I imagine that's getting much more efficient with AI, mm-hmm. because the AI can see...
Yeah,
all the possibilities.
Yeah, and the AI.
So that reduces cost for you.
Yeah, and also error rate. So the AI takes into account this DPD hub or Yodel or whatever. I don't want to single out one. But this hub does perform amazingly well. We must give them more volume. This one, not so much. What's going on here? And then I can, my team calls them and finds out what's going on. Is it a people issue? Is it a lack of training issue?
Do you know that they've got a problem before they do?
Often, yes, yeah. Because we get the data in real time.
Yeah, exactly. So that's quite valuable that they've got that good relationship with you.
Yeah.
So how do you see this growing? How are you going to expand? Because it sounds to me like an entirely positive thing that people can order healthy food quickly and efficiently through Gusto. How are you going to make more people aware of it?
So, I mean, the two things that really resonate are convenience and then health. And so we'll push the proposition quite hard into these directions and offer people even faster choices. And I think we're morphing from being a meal kit subscription business to a much more flexible dinner time solution business, where you can have a lot of healthy options in 5 minutes, 3 minutes, 10 minutes, 60 minutes. And so you get a lot more empowerment as a customer. Right. So we're making the product proposition a lot more flexible. And then look, we launched Ireland as our first international market last year. It's early days. We've only been trading for a year.
Have you got a factory there as well?
We have a small factory.
Where is it?
In Dublin, outskirts of Dublin.
So in Ireland as well?
Yes.
And it's the same app and everything?
I mean, it looks similar to the Brits. The Irish are so proud of their produce, rightfully.
So you want to use local produce.
But they are completely time poor. Just like us in the UK. And so there's a lot of commonality, actually.
Yeah. And it's a smaller population, though, with some places quite remote.
Yes.
So the logistics might be different.
Yes, very different. Yeah. But it's a nice test bed for us, to explore Ireland.
So then you're thinking maybe going to other geographies after that.
Yes. I mean, there's no rush. We really, really want to create value for our customers here in the UK and in Ireland, but eventually...
Yeah.
Yeah, go further.
Okay, well, I think that's a good ambition. What about the sort of packaging aspects? I mean, because you're obviously very focused on sustainability and the purpose of the business being a positive one. How do you manage the packaging so you use materials that are sustainable? Are you able to do that? Because I imagine food needs to be kept fresh, and there are some complexities around that.
There are complexities. So the aim is to shift from today 80% of packaging being recyclable, reusable, compostable to 100% by the end of this year. We may or may not manage to achieve it.
That soon?
Yeah. We're pushing very hard on this. And so there was a Bristol University study in 2023 that concluded every time you eat Gusto, you save 23% of CO2 emissions versus the equivalent supermarket shop. And they looked end to end at the food waste, the packaging, the couriers, everything. And so 7 kilos of CO2 emission are already taken out every time you eat Gusto.
7 kilos?
7 kilos, which is a massive amount.
It really is.
But
I mean,
of course,
if you try lifting 7 kilos, yeah. I mean, are you saying for one order?
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. And so obviously we got to do more. And so we're pushing hard on
packaging. So we're creating
so
much carbon through our eating habits.
Mainly through food waste. Food waste is the biggest evil.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea it was that much.
And a lot of the food waste is hidden, because if Tesco wants to sell salad across its thousands of stores, they have to push salad into all these stores, and then 66% of salad in the UK is wasted. And so it's very, very hard to sell certain products.
Right. So that's a staggering variant. But 100... So this suggests to me that there's quite a lot of innovation going on in the packaging space, mm-hmm. that you can move from 80 to 100% in we're talking like not much more than 6 months now.
Yeah, and we're co-creating solutions with the suppliers, the farmers. And so there's a lot of helpful thinking across our partners.
So does that mean we have in prospect a world where there isn't going to be lots of packaging pollution in the next few years?
Theoretically, yes.
But again, it's about economics, I guess.
Yeah, and enforcement. And, you know, I mean, we talked initially before we started, but I just came back from China, and in all these hotels, China just said, you cannot have plastic bottles anymore. It's bad for the environment. And, you know, China being China, they're enforcing this fairly rigorously.
So what do they use, aluminium or glass?
A combination.
That's what they're using.
Mm.
So did you get a sense that they were much more serious about this than we are?
Because
that's not the message we hear necessarily. We hear China's a polluter. And
I mean, it's changing really, really fast. The places I've visited, are very green now. You've got solar panels everywhere. You've got emission targets for every single building. I was quite impressed.
Right.
And it made the argument, and it brought the argument alive, that for stuff like emissions, you just have to say, this is what you have to do.
Did you go there because you were thinking of opening there, or because you wanted to get some ideas? What took you there?
So I went there to immerse myself in AI and robotics.
Did you? And where did you go?
See the future. I started in Hong Kong, went to Shenzhen, which is mind-boggling. Wow.
Yeah.
45 years ago, this was a fisher town. Now it's 20 million people building the future. It's beyond anything I've seen. And then Beijing.
So you went to Shenzhen. And so when you say, did you go and visit companies there? And
I met 30 founders, CEOs.
How did you set all that up?
Well, luckily I got invited by somebody who set it up very kindly. A big investor named Prozos. They've got 40,000 employees across their portfolio.
Right.
They took 10-ish European CEOs, Brazilian CEOs, Indian CEOs. And so we had an amazing time.
I bet. That sounds eye-opening. But did it make you anxious?
It did. The speed.
It did. Well, because the competition is coming fast. Huh?
It's coming very fast. And China, in a nutshell, is moving from 996, where you're supposed to work from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m.
six days a week.
And now they're saying, no, we're moving to 007. So you work from midnight to midnight 7 days a week. Which obviously means only agents can do
only
this.
Only machines can do
and
that.
And so they're embracing these 007, autonomous...
that's the future.
It's scary. But they're embracing these agents so much faster than us here. And it's all about speed. That's the only mode they have. Just execute.
Right.
It's.
So did you come back with lots of ideas?
Yes.
God, I wish I'd been on that trip. So that sounds very interesting. So anyone who gets a chance to go and see what's going on in China, because I suppose we always think of it happening in California. Have you been out there as well? Or?
I have. And I actually had an invite to OpenAI and see the CEO and founder and all these people. And I also had an invite to China. And so I went to China this time. But I have been to Silicon Valley many, many times.
And was there a difference in the lessons you took away?
I think fundamentally the US and Europe is focused on chips and models.
Right.
In China, it's all about the agent and the agent adoption.
And explain what you mean by the agent.
Well, so in you know, here we talk about chips and NVIDIA chips and how good they are, and we can't give them to the Chinese. The Chinese are leasing them in Japan. They have access. I mean, it's completely... It's the silliest thing I've ever seen.
So they've worked that one out.
Yeah, they're all like, oh, no, we have to release them in Singapore and Japan. Like, okay.
So they've solved that. So go on, what are they doing? And, what's all this about the agent?
So the idea is that agents don't sleep. They don't complain. And they work around the clock. And so they're trying to infuse agents in everything. And so we met, for example, we met a company that last year had 125 agents that would do coding and basic tasks. And then
for customers.
And then they ended the year with 40,000 agents working for them.
Well, these are AI agents.
AI agents. And so they do literally software coding. The Chinese WhatsApp is called WeChat. So in WeChat, you now have a new contact in your contact book that says Agent Joe. And you can literally say, Agent Joe, book me a flight, do this. Because payments are already integrated in the chat message.
And Agent Joe will be your travel agent.
Yeah. And like, literally anything. Get me a taxi, which hotel, what food.
And how do they charge for that? Do you subscribe to Agent Joe? Is that
you subscribe. I mean, I think...
Or do you pay a margin?
The most tangible benefits today are on the cost-saving side.
Right.
You know, suddenly you don't have to employ.
Yeah, but where does that take us? I mean, are you seeing people losing their jobs in China then as a consequence?
I mean, you see extreme FOMO in China. So China on average has $4,000 household income. So it's still pretty poor. However, if your kid graduates with a STEM degree, you predictably will earn $40,000. Right. And so the pressure on that kid is off the chart.
I mean, it's the only kid typically.
It's a gravy train, only kid. Everyone is piling.
10 times your...
10 times. And so that kid and that family, now here's about AI, and the FOMO is enormous. The fear of missing out. I mean, they really, really want to adopt AI before that person adopts AI. And so there is a strong kind of feeling, AI will not take my job, but this
Someone
guy
else
might.
Someone else might, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's fiercely competitive.
So everyone is dabbling in using these agents and technology, and literally everyone.
Was there a agent that you were particularly taken with? So I want to take this agent home with me.
I mean, look, there are a couple of examples. There's one called GenSpark, which is a startup in China that gives you access to all of the frontier models, but then has an agent on top. And so you can literally say, give me the financials of this company.
Right.
Bang. Use the Excel spreadsheet. Now create a podcast for me based on the last financial outcome. I want to listen to it. You know, I've got 10 minutes in my car.
Create a podcast for me on that company's financial outcome.
Yeah.
So I could do that for a competitor or something.
And you can literally say, make it in the voice of Scott Galloway. I like his podcast. Make it very similar. And now create a comic
book. Makes reading competitor accounts more entertaining.
And then, you know, you can say, create a comic now based on the financials they had so that I can look at the comic in 5 minutes and get the main takeaway from the financial report.
And you've done this.
And it all happens in real time. I've done it.
And it works.
It's amazing.
So where do we find this? GenSpark.
GenSpark, as one example.
Right. And what was your second one?
Kling AI.
Kling.
K-L-I-N-G.
Yeah.
For example, it's a video generation app where you upload a picture of us sitting here and you say, make us fly out of the window and turn into birds.
Wow.
And within 90 seconds, it creates an amazingly accurate video.
Right. And you pay. What sort of bird were you?
Good question.
You don't want to tell me.
Just as an example. But I mean,
it's incredible.
And so you know, these apps, and they make money today. Yeah. Sora in the US was losing $2 million a day, and they have the same video capability but make money. And so it's quite astonishing.
So what's the difference there? They've got cheaper labor or they've got smarter execution? Or?
Cheaper labor, cheaper energy. The government is subsidizing
energy. Because that's such a huge cost.
Any AI company gets energy subsidized by the government.
Right.
Plus the government is investing into 80%. 80% of the startups in China that have raised money have raised mainly through the government.
Right.
And so the government is backstopping innovation.
Right. It's taking a big risk then.
Yeah. But it's also very strategic. All these Chinese hosts we met, they all kind of laughed about, oh yeah, the US is so distracted. This is amazing for us. And they're just in a very disciplined way saying, in 5 years, we want to be here.
The US down. They say when you see an enemy make a mistake, leave them to it.
Yeah, that's their mindset.
Right.
And just buckle down. And then you see robots on the streets everywhere. It's very impressive.
It is extraordinary, the pace of change that's coming. So in your business, you're going to be taking these new technologies and applying them.
I mean, we have used AI for the last 10 plus years.
I think you're unusual in that respect. I mean, you saw it early and made that good hire. It's all about making a good hire, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Just to bring it back to recruitment as we wrap
absolutely.
Up. It is, absolutely, you say that. But that made a huge difference to your business.
And
it
is all about people.
Yeah.
And, my moral obligation is to equip these people with agentic knowledge and AI skills, because they still have to work for another 30 years in the world of AI. And so I feel like I have this moral obligation to help people at Gusto. And so I'm sitting down with people who are 20 years all the time and understand how they're thinking about the world and what we can do for them to equip them to succeed.
Right. So what's top of your list?
I mean, you have to embrace these tools. Mm. You just have to, because the world is changing. It will change. And you either embrace it or you don't. And so my job is to really kind of role model using these tools all the time and not being afraid to dabble in them.
Well, you've certainly done that by going to China and coming back and telling us so much about what you saw, which is fascinating and I think will be very helpful to our listeners. Thanks, Timo. Thanks so much for coming in to talk to me. I found that very interesting. And I hope many of our listeners will be ordering some of your meals, because they should do. We all need to eat more healthily. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Now, I always ask two questions at the end that I ask all my guests. The first question, because we love Mondays here at Reed, is what gets you up, Timo, on a Monday morning?
I'm an early bird. I never struggle to get up. But look, for me, it's purpose, it's meaning, it's building with people I love working with. I genuinely get huge joy just working with people I look up to.
And my last question, which is from my interview book, Why You? 101 Questions You'll Never Fear Again, is where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
I mean, fundamentally, I want to be stronger, faster than myself today. And so I'm quite competitive with myself. Can I lift more weight in 5 years? Can I run a bit faster? Am I eating more healthily? Am I seeing the family more? Do I have more quality time in my life? I think that's kind of what constitutes success, really. We live in a world where it's all vanity. And so sanity for me are these metrics. And then look, if I can be the best version of myself, that's good for Gusto. I've got more energy to lead Gusto, and that's good for the business.
Keep lifting those weights. Thanks for coming in, Timo. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Timo, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Reed or Gusto, you'll find the links in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.